Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Judge Bork, I wanted to pick up for a moment one aspect of the line of questioning of the chairman. As I understand your discussion of the Griswold case, there's no right to privacy in the Constitution. It's up to the legislature. Doesn't that lead you to the view that you would uphold a statute requiring, say, a compulsory abortion if a legislature enacted it by majority? Let me just continue. Some of your strongest supporters have made an issue of the allegation that there may be compulsory abortion in the People's Republic of China. And as I understand it, your peculiar constitutional philosophy, you'd be prepared to uphold compulsory abortion in America or some future legislature were enacted. We've just heard you say that the state of Connecticut had the right to pass a law prohibiting married couples from using birth control. So I think a real question is where you draw the line. I think you've opened up a whole can of worms, quite frankly, here. What about a state statute that says families with more than two children can't send their children to public schools? What about all sorts of other statutes that a legislature might enact with some theoretically plausible rationale, such as the Connecticut statute, but which would obviously violate the people's most fundamental rights, including the right to privacy? I believe, Mr. Bork, that in your world, the individuals have a precious few rights to protect them against the majority. And I think this is where the Bill of Rights comes in and what the Bill of Rights is all about, that there are some things in America where no majority can do to the minority or to the individuals. The provisions of the 14th Amendment under Section 1 include, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the due process of law. Isn't the included in the concept of liberty the right to privacy? And in reading that with the Ninth Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. Therefore, the importance of the Bill of Rights. And I'd be interested in your reaction or response, because it seems to me that the issues of privacy have been carefully enshrined within the Constitution by court decisions over the period of the last 60 years. And they are rights which are enshrined in such a way and respected and valued so importantly that I would think Americans would have serious questions, I certainly do, about placing someone on the Supreme Court that is willing to find some kind of a rationale, appears to find some rationale not to respect it.
Senator Kennedy, at the outset, let me say this. I have the greatest respect for the Bill of Rights, and I will enforce the Bill of Rights. I have enforced the Bill of Rights. What we were talking about here was a generalized, undefined right of privacy, which is not in the Bill of Rights. Now, as I said in my opening statement, a judge has to apply law, and the law comes from the text, the history, and the structure of the Constitution. There are important aspects of privacy in the Bill of Rights. This Congress has increased privacy in many ways by statute. As a society, we value it. But as a judge, I don't think I can tell the American people they may not have a law that in no way conflicts with the written and historical Constitution. Now, you raise the question of...
Just before, and I want you to complete, what I was really springing from is your response to the chairman's questions with regard to the Griswold case, that I think we remember as the majority of that case found that the provisions provided by the state statute that restricted married couples from using contraception would be violative of their right to privacy. And you've indicated you took issue with the rationale. And I think you continued and said, well, perhaps someone can come up with a different rationale so that you might be able to reach a different decision. But in response, I think, to the chairman's question, you talked about the importance of the majority in the state legislatures. And you didn't find, at least at this time, that you were prepared to state a philosophy or a legal justification for the overruling of that Connecticut statute. And I believe, quite frankly, following that rationale, you could lead yourself into the kinds of situations which I posed here. And if I'm wrong, I'd like to hear from you on that rationale.
Let me repeat about this created, generalized, and undefined right of privacy in Griswold. Aside from the fact that the right was not derived by Justice Douglas in any traditional mode of constitutional analysis, there is this. The right was not, we don't know what it is. We don't know what it covers. It can strike at random. For example, the Supreme Court has not applied the right of privacy consistently, and I think it's safe to predict the Supreme Court will not. For example, if it really is a right of sexual freedom in private, as some people have suggested, then Bowers against Hardwick, which upheld a statute against sodomy as applied to homosexuals, is wrongly decided. Privacy to do what, Senator? You know, privacy to use cocaine in private? Privacy for businessmen to fix prices in a hotel room? We just don't know what it is.
Well, I think there are some things that people would understand, and that would feel that the government intrusion in terms of married couple, in this case, in terms of their use of contraceptives, in terms of this part, did to go across that border, go across that line. And the kind of examples that I've given you, it would seem to me that that would be equally clear that a state statute that required compulsory abortion would certainly violate what I think most Americans would feel be the right to privacy. And I believe as well that if once you have the state dictating the size of families, it would. And what I'm interested in is how you reach that conclusion, if that would be the conclusion, under your rationale that if a state has got a majority and has got a basis for providing that statute, then it's not up to Judge Bork to look behind that.
It is not up to Judge Bork to look behind that unless he has got law to apply.
Okay, let me
now,
go.
I was going to say furthermore that I don't think, I've never found it terribly useful in testing constitutional theories to use examples that we know the American people will never enact. I mean, the founders of this nation banked a good deal upon the good sense of the people as well as upon the courts.
I just say there, if, Judge Bork, though, one state did with regard to sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
One state did with regards to sterilization, and I think that reaches the same kind of abhorrence in terms of what I would imagine most Americans, and certainly the court did, would be abhorrent. I don't think that our founding fathers might have imagined that as well. But I think you've made the point. I'd be glad to hear you further on it.
If you want to talk about Skinner against Oklahoma, which...
No. I was basically interested, rather getting into the cases, just to get it, the rationale, the reasoning, the way that you do move to reach a decision. So let me go to the issues of quality. I think most Americans are proud that our Supreme Court, for its leadership in the past 30 years in securing the promise of equal justice under law for all Americans, for striking down the Jim Crow laws, vindicating the right to vote, prohibiting discrimination among women, courts helped to bring to an end the reign of prejudice and, I think, create a better America. You've written a great deal over the years about legislation, court decisions designed to ensure equal justice under law, and I'd like to examine some of these views. Perhaps the most significant moral test of the country in the century occurred in the struggle to end race discrimination. And I appreciate your support for the school segregation decision in 1954. But I am troubled because I believe that your clock on civil rights seems to have stopped in 1954. You opposed the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibited discrimination in public accommodations and employment. And the terrible burden of segregation in that period was described by Attorney General Robert Kennedy in his testimony before this committee in support of the Civil Rights Act of 63, and I just quote very briefly. Consider also the innumerable difficulties that face a Negro just traveling from state to state in our country, something the rest of us have taken for granted. If he makes a reservation in advance, they may not be honored. If he seeks accommodations along the way, he's likely to be rejected time after time until, just to obtain lodging and food, he must detour widely from his route. And if he does find accommodations available to him, they are likely to be inferior. That was the reality in America in 1963. That was the evil that the Civil Rights Act was intended to prohibit. But Mr. Bork, you didn't just criticize, you harshly criticized the public accommodations provisions of the Civil Rights of 64. And in your 1963 New Republic article, printed in rather interestingly, in August of 1963, at the time of Dr. King's march to Washington, where he stirred the nation, in your New Republic article, you referred to the principle underlying those provisions as, quote, a principle of unsurpassed ugliness. And then in your article of March 1st, 1964, Chicago Tribune, you also expressed your opposition to the public accommodations provision and to the title of the proposed Civil Rights Act that would bend discrimination in employment as well. Isn't that correct?
I don't recall about the employment center. I wonder if I might have a copy of those two pieces.
Sure. I'll ask the staff to get those. I mean, do you remember or you don't remember the use of word, a principle of unsurpassed ugliness?
I remember that. I also remember, Senator, that I said that racial segregation by law was also of unsurpassed ugliness. And but, what I was... let me back up and tell you how this article came about and
could,
why.
Could I just... let me just frame the question, if those quotes are correct, about when you first publicly changed your position on the Civil Rights Act. That would be the question, given the two articles which you offered in 63 and in 64. When did you first publicly change your position on the Civil Rights Act?
I don't know if I did it in the classroom or not. I know that the first time
you've written on two important public declarations. I think we're entitled to know if you were prepared to make those comments and write in public comment, I'd be interested in when you made some public comment or statement. I think our friend from Pennsylvania indicated you've made many speeches all during this period of time, and I'd be interested in when you might be able to indicate to us that you changed your civil rights, your position on the Civil Rights Act.
Well, I think it's implicit in some of the things I wrote earlier, but I first said it, I think, where it was written down, at least, in a confirmation hearing in 1973. But, one has to know the evolution of my thinking about political matters to understand where that article came from and why I no longer agree with it and haven't agreed with it for a long time. One has also to know that as Solicitor General, I enforced the rights of racial minorities in court often further than the Supreme Court was willing to go. You should also know, Senator, that on my present court, I have frequently voted for black plaintiffs in various kinds of civil rights or voting rights cases.
But just on this point, as a Solicitor General, you're really representing your client, aren't you? Aren't you representing the United States at those cases?
I am indeed, representing your client. I didn't have to go that far if I didn't want to.
Okay. to do.
I think it's important to know how this came about. I had come to Yale as an avid free market type. I had gotten into classical economics, which teaches that, by and large, it's much better to let people arrange their own affairs and their own transactions than to try to govern them by law. I made the what I now regard as not uncommon intellectual mistake of trying to apply those principles to social interactions. I don't think it works there because you haven't got a marketplace to discipline people. But it is not uncommon for free market economists to display libertarian principles. This article came about because I was arguing with Alex Bickel about this subject. I, at that time, thought that any coercion of the individual by government had to be justified by a principle that did not lead government into all kinds of coercion that should not be there. And I could not see a general philosophical principle here that justified this coercion. I also could not see a general philosophical principle that would justify segregation by law. I was leaning on the side of individual freedom. I think that was wrong, because I don't think any general principle is available. I now take what I would call, at least what Bickel described as the Edmund Burke approach, which is you look at each measure. This is a political matter, not a judicial matter. You look at each measure and ask whether it will do more good than harm. Had I looked at the civil rights proposals in that way, I would have, as I later came to, recognized that they do much more good. In fact, they make everybody much happier, and they help bring the nation together in a way that otherwise would not have occurred.
Well, the point, I believe, is a simple one. At a time when men and women in the South and North, Republicans and Democrats, recognized that race discrimination had to be outlawed in America, you strongly and publicly opposed civil rights legislation, calling its underlying principle one of unsurpassed ugliness. And it wasn't until 10 years later, when you were nominated to be Solicitor General, that you publicly repudiated those views. And
Senator, I don't usually keep issuing my new opinions every time I change my mind. I just don't. If I revisit the subject, I revisit it, but I don't keep issuing loose leaf services about my latest state of mind.
The point is that I would make here is that you felt it was sufficiently important to publish your views at a time when we were having a national debate in the early part of the 1960s on civil rights legislation. We were having a national debate in 1968 on the whole issues of fair housing. We were having a national debate in 1972 on the civil rights legislation. And you didn't feel, even though that these were the matters that were right before the American people and the Congress of the United States, sufficiently aroused in terms of your altered or changed views, that you were prepared to publish those matters. And I wish you'd been as quick to publicize your change of heart as you were to broadcast your opposition to the most important civil rights legislation.
Well, the opposition took place entirely because I got into an argument with Alex Bickel. He wrote frequently for the New Republic, and he asked me to write it up. And I must say, when he saw it, he said, "Your article is a version of liberal thought." But let me say one other thing. The concern about the rights of liberty as well as equality was by no means an unusual one then. When Congress came to face the fair housing laws, Congress began to make exceptions for Mrs. Murphy's boarding house because they were worried about coercing the individual in that way. When, a few years after I wrote this article, Justice Harlan dissented in a lunch counter sit-in case, talking about the freedom of the individual and the rights of equality as being competing constitutional considerations. I think I was wrong there. I don't think I was in bad company with Justice Harlan and this Congress. But those are serious matters, and it is no small thing to coerce generally. Now, I was afraid that the principle of this legislation could lead to coercion of association everywhere. I now realize that we legislate partially and never legislate on a general principle, so that there's no danger that this kind of thing would expand into other areas of coercion.
Weren't you worried about the coercion that was happening to millions of blacks in this country, and also those are being coerced because of lack of opportunity for equal employment? Weren't mm-hmm. you equally concerned about that type of coercion, Judge Bork?
You mean private coercion?
Yeah, sure. Public as well as governmental activity.
Well, governmental activity, I said in this article, was wrong. If you segregate by race, I said that was a principle of unsurpassed ugliness too. And you will read my writings from beginning to end, and you will never find a mark of racial or ethnic hostility. And you will find consistent support for
some.
Well,
I was talking about the coercion that comes in the public accommodations, at the lunch counters, in the hotels, in those places which I illustrated before. I wish, quite frankly, you had demonstrated as much concern about the coercion that was happening to those citizens that were being coerced as you apparently were concerned about others. Let me go to the issue of poll taxes. The right to vote is cornerstone free society. For decades, poll taxes were used to keep poor Americans, often racial minorities, from exercising the franchise. Harper v. Virginia Board of Elections, which was decided in 66, Supreme Court struck down the poll tax because it deprived poor Americans of equal protection of the laws by barring them from exercising their fundamental right to vote. And in its majority opinion, the court stated wealth or fee-paying has, in our view, no relation to voting qualifications. The right to vote is too precious, too fundamental to be so burdened or conditioned. Judge Bork, isn't it true that in your confirmation hearings to be Solicitor General in 73, you testified that you thought the Harper, and I quote, as an equal protection case, seemed to be wrongly decided? You were asked whether, as far as the welfare of the nation was concerned, the Harper case was correctly decided. Am I correct that you answered, I do not really know about that. As I recall, it was a very small poll tax. It was not discriminatory, and I doubt it had much impact on the welfare of the nation one way or the other. And then you were asked about the constitutional issue, and you respond, I think that is a question of degree. It depends on the size of the poll tax. Do you remember? Is that an accurate?
As I recall it, Senator, yes.
Now, am I correct that in 85, in your foreword to the Constitution and Contemporary Theory, you again suggest the Supreme Court had been wrong to strike down the poll tax in the Harper case? Have you?
Sure, I'm willing to discuss that case fully, Senator.
Yeah. I'm just wondering if you've changed your view that the Supreme Court was wrong in the Harper case to hold that poll taxes are unconstitutional.
I think it was, and I will tell you why. And I have no desire to bring poll taxes back into existence. I don't like them myself. But if that had been a poll tax applied in a discriminatory fashion, it would have clearly been unconstitutional. It was not. I mean, there was no showing in the case. It was just a $1.50 poll tax. This Congress had just recently drafted and proposed to the states and had adopted an anti-poll tax amendment to the Constitution, which this Congress carefully limited to federal elections so as to leave state poll taxes in place if states chose to have them. That seemed to me a little odd, therefore, that the court would come along and mop up something that Congress did not bother to amend the Constitution to accomplish. Not didn't bother, deliberately didn't. The poll tax was familiar in American history, and nobody ever thought it was unconstitutional unless it was racially discriminatory. Now, in Harper itself, Justice Black, who was hardly a man who was insensitive to voting rights, Justice Harlan and Justice Stewart all dissented from the majority holding. Justice Black said the court was using the old natural law due process formula to write into the Constitution notions of what it thinks is good government policy. Harper overruled a prior case in which the majority had upheld the poll tax, and that in that case, Justices Black, Frankfurter, and Jackson, and others upheld the poll tax. Archibald Cox has said, and I quote, that the opinion seems almost perversely to repudiate every conventional guide to legal judgment, although he liked the result. I like the result, too. I just don't see the legal judgment there. And Alexander Bickel made much the same criticism. It is a decision that is hard to square with our constitutional history.
Well, it was not only on the basis of a race, it was also on the question of discrimination of the poor. I remember very well because I offered that amendment on the 64 Act. And I suppose the question is how high a price should a poor person have to be able to pay to exercise the fundamental right to vote? You and I may not have to worry about where each dollar goes, but there are a lot of Americans who do. And to suggest that a poll tax, if it's small enough, does not deprive a poor person of a fundamental aspect of citizenship, well, that reminds me of the Anatole France's famous remark that the law in its majestic equality forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under the bridges and to beg in the streets and to steal bread. The oath every judge and justice takes require him to do equal right to the poor as well as to the rich, and I just think we have to be sensitive to the realities, not just legal technicalities. Let me go to the one man, one vote. In years past, one of the great obstacles to real democratic representation in the country occurred when state legislatures portioned themselves in ways that systematically reduced the voting strength of particular constituencies. Drawing election districts with different sized population enabled some groups to maintain more of their share of power at the expense of others. And Judge Bork and the Reynolds v. Sims back in 1964, the Supreme Court held the Constitution requires election districts and states and localities to be apportioned in a way that meets the one-man, one-vote standard so that the legislative district contains roughly equal populations. Isn't it true? In 1968, you wrote in Fortune magazine that, and I quote, on no reputable theory of constitutional adjudication was there an excuse for the doctrine it imposed.
I think, Senator, I not only wrote that, I still think I was right, and I'll discuss it with you. For one, we might start off by observing that the Senate of the United States would be an unconstitutional body if that rationale of one man, one vote were applied here.
Well, that's entirely different, as you're too good a professor to understand that you use the different requirement at the time the Constitution was adopted, and that was the New Jersey plan, and that was accepted by the Founding Fathers.
That is entirely true. On the other
hand, that's a different kind of criteria, and you know that as well as the rest of us.
The reason for allowing certain units to have equal votes, even though their populations aren't equal, apply as well in a state legislature or a state senate as it does here. But passing that, it should be said that I agreed with Baker against Carr, which was the case which first held over the dissent of Justices Frankfurter and Harlan, which first held that the courts could get into reapportionment. There was a subject matter they could take up.